During the dark days of World War II, Australia built a large and sophisticated intelligence network from scratch, resulting in Australian codebreakers cracking Japanese Army and Air Force codes. Those codebreakers played a vital role in the battles of Midway, Milne Bay, the Coral Sea, Hollandia and Leyte.
My name's David Dufty and I am a writer and researcher. I've previously worked in academia and for social research companies and as well as for the ABS in previous roles, but these days I'm a writer and a researcher, and my latest book is The Secret Codebreakers of the Central Bureau on Second World Codebreaking in Australia.
Hello David and welcome to Service Voices. I'm really interested in the subject of this book. I've started to read it. I'm about halfway through, but there's so much in it. Can we just start off by saying, and this is in your book, on the 1st of September 1939, World War II began with a German bombing attack on a little Polish town called Wieland. It had no strategic significance. There were no Polish troops there.
Right. And it's interesting that the very first act in World War II was to bomb a hospital, unbelievably. Yeah, so, and then it went from there. Germany invaded Poland and that triggered a sequence of events and treaties being brought in, and it was the start of the Axis nations expanding and conquering and recapturing land that they would say recapturing, capturing land that they believed was rightfully theirs, starting with Poland and moving on. And so, yes, and so by the end of the war, it was worldwide conflagration. It took over 60 million lives, and it was by far the deadliest war in human history. Nothing else even really comes close.
It was an incredible loss of life and untold suffering and devastation, shocking. Now, that attack on that little Polish town, why did they attack that town in particular?
Oh, look, I think, well, it was, that attack was really just the start of a massive invasion of Poland. They had over a million troops ready on the border, ready to come across. And I think they just wanted a light target, to be honest. It was just a warm-up, really, for the main event.
That led on to Australia's involvement in the war. You mentioned the Axis nations. Explain what you meant by Axis.
Okay, the Axis nations were the nations which were basically allied with each other, which were Germany, Austria, Italy and Japan. Now, Japan didn't initially enter the war in the sense of being engaged with the, in terms of the European war, but the Axis nations had an alliance. They were expanded as Germany and the original nations moved outwards and captured more territory and more nations. And so World War II was often characterised as being the Axis versus what's known as the Allies, and that was Britain, Australia, the Commonwealth Nations, the United States and so forth. So, but whilst all this action was taking place, whilst all this warfare was taking place, there was a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes in terms of intelligence and code-breaking and technological development, which really had a huge effect on the shaping of the outcome of the war.
And that also involved Australia, didn't it? And South Australia in particular, we had one chap, Eric Nave, was drawn into the war. Can you give us a bit of a background about that?
Sure. Yes, Eric Nave was Australia's first codebreaker. Now, he actually started out as a young man at the tail end of the First World War, and he wanted to enlist in the war, and they, for various reasons, they allowed him to join the Navy, but only on the proviso that he had to be a permanent enlistment. So at the end of the war, whilst most other young men were coming home, leaving the military and going back to normal life, he was basically stuck in the Navy, and he was an extremely intelligent young man. So he started learning Japanese, and he went and studied Japanese in Japan for a couple of years. Then he was recruited by the British, and he learned code breaking and signals intelligence from the British, from what was later known as Bletchley Park. He was actually away from Australia for many, many years prior to the Second World War. Eric Nave was the first person of any Allied nation to break any Japanese code. He was the first before any of the British code breakers or American code breakers. He was the first person to do that. He was an important code breaker. He came back to Australia. He was stationed in Singapore, and he actually returned to Australia in 1940. And that's when there was a guy in Australia in the Navy called Jack Newman who was trying to get sort of code-breaking going in Australia, and he was really very happy that this gem, Eric Nave, had dropped into his lap, effectively, and so he put him to work and started building up code-breaking in Australia. This was before even Japan entered the war, but they were working on Japanese codes back then. So anyway, so Eric Nave and a very small team in Melbourne were basically working on developing Australian capability in code-breaking from a very early point in the war, with a focus on Japan, and this was even before Japan entered the war.
Did you need to know Japanese in order to break their codes?
Well, you needed somebody who knew Japanese. So you didn't have everybody who was working on code breaking didn't have to, but at some point you decrypt a message and you finally get the actual message and it's in Japanese, so somebody's going to have to read it. So yes, there needed to be Japanese experts, and it's interesting, some of them were very deeply involved. These linguists were very deeply involved in the actual code breaking. There was Eric Nave, who was an expert linguist and a very fluent Japanese speaker, and also an expert code breaker. But he was not the only one. There were others. There was a guy called Nobby Clark, who was fluent in languages, including Japanese, and he also was involved. So there were linguists who were sort of crossing the border, as it were, between being translators and code breakers. And another one from Adelaide, in fact, called Don Laidlaw. He wasn't as high up as those guys, but he was involved. He was a translator during the war, Japanese translator, and also worked on breaking codes as well.
Did these people come from all different services and civilian life, or were they all put into the Navy?
Oh, no, they came from everywhere. There were two code-breaking organisations in Australia in the Second World War. One was focused on the main naval code called JN25, and they were in Melbourne, and they were pretty singular in their drive to just crack this one major naval code. They were called FRUML, which stood for Fleet Radio Unit Melbourne. And they were a joint Australian Navy and US Navy collaboration. The other one was in Brisbane for most of the war, but then they moved to the Philippines later. And they were called Central Bureau, and they did Army codes, Air Force codes, and even some of the Navy codes that FRUML weren't interested in. So Central Bureau basically broke the Japanese Army codes. This is an organisation in Australia. Again, it was joint Australian Army, Australian Air Force, and US Army, and a gathering of a few other people as well, including some professors from Sydney University. And they broke several important codes and had a big impact on the course of the war. And they were called Central Bureau, by the way. The reason this code-breaking organisation in Australia was called Central Bureau was because when they were sitting around in Melbourne and they made the decision to form this secret organisation, they didn't want people finding out about it or gossiping about it or overhearing conversations about it and getting interested. So they said, well, what's the most boring, nondescript name we can come up with? So they settled on Central Bureau. They agreed that was literally the most boring name they could think of. And that way nobody would pay any attention to it. Started off with just a handful of people. And by the end of the war, there were 4,000 people involved in Central Bureau, both spread in Australia, across the Southwest Pacific. 4,000 people, completely top-secret organisation. It's incredible that they were able to keep this whole thing under wraps, such a massive, massive operation.
Goodness,
but they did.
4,000 people in intelligence.
Yes. Oh, it was huge. It was absolutely a huge undertaking. Well, there were two reasons why they needed so many people. Firstly, what the Japanese were doing was they were communicating basically by radio waves, right? And so now, if you want to actually do some code breaking, you need to actually be listening or getting the messages that the enemy is sending, right? So in order to do that, they had to deploy teams, these guys who were, and actually one team of women, put them as close as they could to the enemy. Sometimes they were in like remote tropical islands, and they'd just set up their own makeshift antennas, put on headphones, and start writing down. It was all Japanese Morse. So they'd grueling work, by the way, grueling work, and they're just writing down Japanese Morse on bits of paper, bundling it up, and sending it back to Australia where it could be decoded. These people worked very hard, did this for years. And so, but the more teams you had out there, the more secret units you had deployed in Northern Australia or in New Guinea or the Philippines, the more messages you could get, the more stuff you had to actually work with. And so Central Bureau kept training up these teams, sending them out, and some of them actually had code breakers in the teams themselves. So if a message came in that they thought they could decrypt on the spot, you know, maybe it was something about an incoming air raid or troop movements nearby, they wouldn't even bother sending it back to Australia. They'd just break it there. They had a little special tent for the intelligence people just out in the middle of the jungle or on an island, and they would decrypt the code then and there. So that's one reason. And the second reason is because they didn't have computers. Now, Central Bureau actually did bring in a couple of computers from America. They were very IBM machines, but they were very clunky, sort of almost, primitive, if you like, versions of what we think of as computers today. But for the most part, everything that was done had to be done by hand. It had to be done manually. And so when you're working with really tricky, complex problems like trying to break into an enemy's code system, you just need a big workforce. Those are the two reasons why there were so many people involved in this this secret work.
And having so many people and spread across such a wide range of terrain, surely they would have been facing grave danger as the Japanese advanced.
They did. Luckily, none of these intercepts, none of these people really ever got discovered by the Japanese. If they had been, they would have surely been targeted. Some of them died due to just the hardships of the conditions, malaria and so on, but not actually directly due to the enemy. Although there is, I did speak to one Central Bureau veteran who they were attacked by machine gun fire in the middle of the night, and then there was a big chase through the jungle. But other than that, those incidents were pretty... it's not completely true that none of the signals operators were killed by the enemy. There was one radio team. The start of it all in Australia was this one special wireless team in Crete. This was before even the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. This was when Australia was still basically focused on the Germans. And their job, they set up a little camp at the top of a hill on Crete, and their job was to listen into German radio messages, decrypt, break them, translate them, and tell the generals, the nearby generals, what was going on. Now, they were doing that, so these guys were basically radio nerds and intelligence and code-breaking people. But then there was a paratroop attack on Crete, and so when that happens, it doesn't matter what your job is, you're going to have to pick up a gun, and that's exactly what happened. So, yes, it was hard work, and it was dangerous work.
Was any of their paperwork ever captured by the enemy?
Not Central Bureau's paperwork, but I believe that the enemy did capture some Allied codes. But the Japanese did not invest the same amount of effort into code breaking as we did.
Now, you mentioned that a lot of these people were on scattered islands. How were they got off these islands? Did they send a ship for them, or did they have to...
Oh, well, they'd be taken by ship or plane or whatever. And actually, when I was researching this book, one of the things that I was pleasantly surprised about was how many of the people involved were still alive, still around, and willing to talk to me, and they really wanted to have their story told, and were very, very supportive of my project. And so I've spoken to people who were involved in the code breaking in Australia, in Melbourne and in Brisbane, as well as people who were deployed as on these intercept sites, these secret wireless units around the Pacific. It's just been an incredible experience to talk to them and meet them and hear their stories firsthand.
Were they governed by the Official Secrets Act? Is that why they didn't speak about it much for many years?
Yeah, they were at first. They were all told you can never speak it. So at the end of the war, and you had this massive apparatus of code breaking and what's called signals intelligence apparatus of all these thousands of people. And as they were demobilized, or demobbed as it was called at the time in 1945 and early 1946, they were all told you can't speak about this. That's it. You can't ever talk about it. There was a 30-year rule. They weren't actually told it's going to be 30 years and then you're fine. Nobody actually told them that. After 30 years, they were then told, oh, by the way, you know, they learned that they could now speak, but they weren't told that at the end of the war. As a result of that, one of the problems for these veterans was that they didn't get any recognition, and they weren't even able to go in Anzac Day marches, because if you go in an Anzac Day march, what banner do you march? There's no such thing as Central Bureau. There was no Central Bureau banner or one wireless unit banner with a secret wireless unit in Townsville in New Guinea. So So they had no banner to march under. And in fact, one guy, Jack Brown, went to one of the first Anzac Day marches, and he was basically mocked as being somebody who had sort of, because he couldn't say what he'd done. So the other veterans thought he had sat out the war. And it was a very negative experience for him, and he never went back to Anzac Day. And so these people who did incredible things sat every Anzac Day, they just sat at home watching it on TV. They really had nothing, they couldn't participate. And so they didn't get any recognition for the work that they did. And the sad thing is, even after some of this stuff started to come to light, 30 years after the war, there still really wasn't a recognition in Australia of the important contribution that Central Bureau and the other code-breaking organisations did in contributing to the war effort, because they really did make an impact on the war.
Obviously, yes.
And so one of the driving motivations for me as I started to write this book was I kind of, because some of them were actually quite sort of, can I say, bitter about the fact that they hadn't actually been given any recognition by the government. And you asked me earlier what got me into this, right? What got me into this was in 2012, there were a couple of feature articles in the Australian newspapers. There was one in The Australian and there was one in Fairfax about Australian code breakers from the Second World War. Because what happened was they got, in about 2011 and 2012, all the ones who were still alive got a medal called a Bletchley Park Medal made of solid gold in the mail and a signed letter from the then Prime Minister, David Cameron. And the Australian government has still not done anything like this for them. And so when these medals started turning up for these Australians, you know, there were some articles in the paper about them, a couple of feature articles, and I couldn't believe it. I was reading it because I knew all about the story about, you know, Alan Turing and breaking the Enigma, the German cipher machine, and what the British did in terms of code breaking. I knew that story. And I couldn't believe when I was reading these articles that there was this whole other story in Australia of Australian code breakers breaking the Japanese Army and Air Force codes. And I knew nothing, and nobody else seemed to really know much about it either. And so that's when I started looking into it. And so the starting point was really I just found anybody who I could and just started calling up the veterans of the code breaking and signals intelligence veterans and just saying, hi, I'm interested in your story. Can I come and visit or can I have a talk to you about your experiences in the war? And they really were happy that somebody was interested and wanting to tell their story.
I love it that they're now getting recognition. Pity it's come so late.
Yeah, it really is a pity. And even so, there still hasn't really been the sort of official recognition that I think they deserve. There has been some attempts to give them recognition, but not to the extent. I mean, the fact that the British government has done this and the Australian government hasn't is, I think, just a travesty. And even at the end of the war, a couple of years after the war, I think it was in 1947, the Americans, they didn't offer to give medals to everybody involved, but three of the really key people, the US Army, wrote to the Australian government and said, look, there are three guys who were involved in Central Bureau, the code-breaking organisation. We really want to give these guys medals. They were Mick Sanford, who actually came from Adelaide, Stan Clark, a radio guy from Melbourne, incredible story as well, and Roy Booth. And the Australian government wrote back and said, well, you know, we don't actually even know what they did during the war, because there was no records, right, because the whole thing was secret. We don't even know what they did. So you can't give them your medals. And so then the Americans sort of said, well, you know, they did really important stuff. But for some reason, and I don't fully get why the Australian government had, and I think still has, this attitude, there's a real reluctance to acknowledge them. And there was back then, and that seems to have continued.
So you're telling me, David, that there is no memorial to the code breakers in Canberra?
No, that's right. Now, there is the building where they worked for a lot of the war in Brisbane has two plaques. One of them was actually funded by the Central Bureau veterans themselves. It wasn't an official thing. They just put their money together, bought themselves a plaque and laid it at the building, organised a little plaque-laying ceremony for themselves, which I think is amazing, but again, an absolute travesty that they had to do that. Then there was another one organised by the Australian Signals Directorate that was laid in 2015. That was a more formal plaque-laying ceremony, but again, it would be nice if they actually did what the British had done and actually acknowledged all the individuals and their contribution.
Absolutely.
Which still hasn't happened.
Let's look at the consequences of some of that work that they did during the war.
Sure, absolutely. Well, one of the most famous incidents, I guess, is the shooting down of Admiral Yamamoto. Now, just to give a bit of background, Yamamoto was the head of the Japanese Navy. The commander-in-chief. You can't get any higher a person than that in the enemy's forces. He was the mastermind behind Pearl Harbor and behind the Battle of Midway. And what happened was there was a signal, basically, there was an Australian interceptor called Keith Falconer, was his actual name, he's nicknamed Zero, and he intercepted a radio message that had the Admiral Yamamoto, because Yamamoto wanted to visit the frontline troops down sort of close to Australia, actually, to an island called Balalay and another one called Buin, and he wanted to fly down past Bougainville. Zero Falconer heard this message on the radio. He didn't know what it meant because it was all in Morse, but he took it down and it was sent to Central Bureau, decrypted. They learnt that it was the Admiral Yamamoto's itinerary. And so now the message had been picked up by the American Navy, but because the Japanese had changed their code books, they couldn't quite read the itinerary. So when they got the Central Bureau version, they were able to figure out where he was going to be and put the two together, put their own version that they'd captured with the ones the Australians had got, and then they sent a squadron of P-38s out and they shot him out of the sky. Now, it wasn't a major battle, but it's a very notorious, if you like, event from the Second World War, the shooting down of Yamamoto. But what's never actually happened is a full acknowledgement of the role that Australian signals interceptors and Australian codebreakers played in that event. Because Eric Nave, codebreaker originally from Adelaide, he broke the Japanese Air Force code. The Japanese had two Air Force codes, two Air Forces, I should say, each with their own code system. The Army had its own Air Force and the Navy had its own Air Force. Eric Nave broke both of those systems. He broke the Japanese Navy Air Force code system in 1942, and then he broke the other Air Force's code system in 1943. So it was only because of his work, Eric Nave's code-breaking work, were they able to read the contents of that message and find out where Yamamoto was. So Eric Nave played a critical role. Zero Falconer also played a critical role. So that's one thing. But also the other thing was Central Bureau got really good at studying what's called metadata, and so what's called today metadata. And so they were just studying, rather than even breaking the messages, they were just sort of looking at the ebb and flow and of messages across the Pacific, who was talking to who and where, and putting together a really good picture of what was going on. So you didn't even need to know what was said. All you need to know is that a message was sent. And the guy that was really good at that, he actually got involved by mistake. His name was Stan Clark, or Pappy Clark, they nicknamed him. He was writing a radio kids show called Teeny Weenies. And so, you know, when he enlisted to the Army, he put down radio, right, on his enlistment form. And so they, oh, you know about radios. You know, you must be a technical wizard. So they got him involved in all this secret intelligence work. A complete misunderstanding, you know, writing kids shows. But he turned out to be a genius at this stuff. He was amazing. And he was really good at finding new ways to put the whole picture together. And at the end of the war, and this is another thing that I've brought to light in my book that I don't believe has ever been told before, at the end of the war, after MacArthur learned that the Japanese were willing to surrender, he was like, okay, the Japanese have surrendered. Let's talk to them so that we can organise a surrender, you know, signing of a document so that the war can actually stop. And so while everyone's popping champagne, they're trying to figure out, because the war's still on and the Japanese still occupy Singapore and everything, so how do they break through to communicate? They needed to do that to actually stop the war, and MacArthur's signals officer said, I know a guy who knows more about the Japanese radio network than anybody else. An Australian called Stan Clark. So they flew Stan Clark into Manila, and he had control over a team, and he was the first person to make radio contact with the Japanese at the end of the war, an Australian. And that doesn't seem, I believe that's as an unknown story told for the first time in my book.
Wow.
So, look, they had an impact on, basically, they were able to tell MacArthur where the troops weren't. And so his famous what's called cartwheel strategy, where instead of having these head-to-head battles, he'd literally sail around them and cut them off instead. And so thus avoiding head-to-head confrontations, reducing the loss of life actually on both sides, because Central Bureau, the Australian codebreakers, were able to tell him where the troops were and where the enemy was not. That's a really key point. So, yes, I believe that the Australian Codebreaking Organisation, Central Bureau, saved the lives of Australians, Americans and Japanese, believe it or not, because they were able to advise on how to hop back north to the Philippines and ultimately Japan without coming into conflict with the major Japanese strongholds.
And that's an incredibly major contribution to winning the war and to saving lives. Incredibly
right.
Major.
Mm. Yes.
All the more reason why they deserve their medals.
Absolutely. An interesting thing about Central Bureau was that it had a very sort of... It was not a very regimented organisation. It had a very flat structure. It was very loose in its structure. People didn't actually have to wear uniforms as such a lot of the time. Sometimes when visiting officials came to get a tour of the place, there'd be some consternation because people were not dressed properly, but they could wear whatever hat they wanted. And part of the reason for this was because the driving force in building up Central Bureau was a guy called Alistair Sanford, or nicknamed Mick Sanford. He was from Adelaide. He was from a very well-known Adelaide family, and he trained at Oxford, and he'd also been trained by the British intelligence. He actually first was operational in Crete with a 4 Special Wireless Unit on Crete, and when he turned up, it was run by this really salt-of-the-earth kind of old guard World War I veteran called Jack Ryan, who someone described as a bulldog, right? And so Sanford, who was actually openly homosexual, turned up on Crete. There was some consternation because Sanford, he didn't hide it. He'd rub it in their face. He actually turned up at his first parade with this unit wearing a bright purple jacket. Right, and he made the officers, because he was one of the officers, he made them use tablecloths and so forth. And so at first, so these diggers on Crete were a little bit sort of, there was a bit of pushback against him, but they pretty soon realised that he was the real deal, and he was not only brilliant, he was fearless. During an air raid, there's actually one story that a veteran told me about Sanford. There was all these German planes overhead, and they were all bunkered down, and he got sick of it and grabbed a rifle and was walking around outside trying to shoot the planes with his rifle. So they figured out pretty soon that he was actually the real deal. When they came back to Australia, it was his energy and his, I guess, brilliance and vision that built this code-breaking organisation, Central Bureau, from a sort of a small ragtag group into a massive behemoth that stretched halfway across the world and with 4,000 people. Sanford had a very anti-authoritarian streak. He was contemptuous of military rituals, and I think he inculcated a certain sort of culture within Central Bureau that was perhaps not always looked on kindly from the outside. But because they didn't actually answer to the military as such. They just answered directly to MacArthur's signals officer. That was it. So they bypassed everything, and they could basically do their own thing. Which they did, and they did very well.
But I could imagine that lack of the military aspect of it would rub some noses up the wrong way. How did they go about working together, the Australians and the Americans?
Well, really well, actually. That's a good question. It depends on where you're talking. So in Central Bureau, the Australians and the Americans worked really well together. They cooperated. Originally, they had sort of... they were designated to different things. So, you know, the Australians were involved in what I was describing earlier with sort of metadata, as well as, Eric Nave doing the Air Force codes, and then the Americans were supposed to do some different stuff, other codes. And then they just, in the end, they just would swap, you know, they'd swap people. Americans would join the Australian teams, depending on where they were needed or what they were good at. It was a very good working relationship. Other organisations, so the naval codebreakers, Frommel down in Melbourne, they had a slightly more tense working relationship, but they still were able to make progress. So I think it depends on where it really, and it also depended on who the people were at the top. If you had Australia and America cooperating, if the top guys got on well, the organisation seemed to work well. If they didn't get on well, or if one of them was, you know, playing political games, then the whole thing would sort of grind to a halt. But no, they're great stories about... I mean, they made lifelong friends, some of these people, with the Australians and the Americans.
Did we have any women code breakers in their midst?
We certainly did. There was a woman, Judy Rowe, who I talk about a bit in my book. She later became a professor of mathematics, but she was working with Professor Room, who was another codebreaker from Sydney, as well as with Eric Nave, Australia's, you know, basically preeminent codebreaker. So she was actually doing actual cryptographic work. She was really doing the real thing. And another one was, and I talk about her in my book quite a bit as well, is Joan Duff, now Joan Fairbridge. Since my book came out, there's been a couple of articles about her in the paper because she's still around and she's amazing. She's been really supportive of me writing this book and very helpful in providing her stories. But she started off in the very early days of intelligence in Melbourne, and she first started working with Jack Newman and Eric Nave, and then she was working with the codebreakers, the naval codebreakers at Monterey Flats, Frommel in Melbourne. She basically did almost a sort of a tour of secret organisations in Australia and knew a lot, and she knew all of the key players. She was amazing for me because she was able to tell me about important people that I was trying to write about from the Second World War, who she knew, and she could describe their mannerisms and little quirky details, fantastic stuff, and just really has a way with words as well. So Joan Duff was deeply involved in code breaking and traffic analysis. She was actually tracking the ships, the Japanese ships, and played a role prior to the Battle of the Coral Sea. And so one of the things that happened with the Coral Sea was that there was a very strong code-breaking aspect to that, because it was the code-breakers who actually figured out that the Japanese wanted to invade Port Moresby and told the generals, said, look, they're coming. They've amassed a massive fleet and they're coming south. So another woman who was involved, and I tell her story in my book as well, is a woman called Coral Osborne, and after the war she was Coral Hines. She's still living in Melbourne, and she's told me her amazing story as well. So she was dealing with what's called Type-X machines, which was basically our version of the Enigma. And she and her boyfriend, he was stationed in the Philippines, and she was supposed to be sending important messages on the Type-X machines, but she was actually also using it to send love letters back and forth to Sandy, her boyfriend. And after the war, they got married. It's a beautiful story. But, in fact, there were large numbers of Australian women were involved in Central Bureau and in the naval code breaking. So large numbers of Australian women, they helped out at all levels. And they played a really important role, and they worked really hard. There was even an all-women team of radio interceptors that went across to Perth, and they were listening into all the radio messages that were the Japanese radio messages from Singapore. But so what happened in 1945 was that MacArthur decided he was going to relocate, because the war had sort of moved north, and the Philippines was being recaptured in preparation for a push against Japan. MacArthur had this fairly novel thing for a general. He kept on moving his headquarters fairly close to the front lines. And so everywhere he went, Central Bureau went as well, the Australian-based code-breaking organisation. So they moved. So he said, well, I'm going to Manila in the Philippines, and so Central Bureau is coming too. But the problem was there was this law in Australia that women could not serve on active service outside of the Australian mainland. They had some proviso. I think it was, you know, up to 500 Australian women total from the total from the population could do it. But you know, this was near the end of World War II. That limit had been, you know, a long time previously. So basically, the government said the law was women could not go overseas to help out with the military. And so Central Bureau had all these women working in it. And they said, well, we need to take them with us to Manila. And the government said, no, you can't take them. They've got to stay behind. And it's like, well, we need them. And so there was this back and forth trying to get the government to agree. And in the end, they decided, well, look, we'll call in the big guns. The government, we'll call in General MacArthur, because at the time, you know, supposedly MacArthur was revered by the government and, he got anything he wanted. Basically, he was the American general running the war from Australia until he moved north. And MacArthur himself said to the Australian government, to the cabinet, look, I know you've got this law, but I really need these women. They're critical. We need them in Manila. And so the cabinet considered that and said, no, you can't have them. They've got to stay behind. So the women ended up staying behind. So they had to actually split the entire organisation. They sent the men north and they kept the women behind, and they just communicated as best they could back and forth. So again, a really backward thinking, I think, from the Australian government back then in terms of not really appreciating the important role that women could play and did play in helping win the war.
And continued to play throughout the Korean War, the Vietnam War. Yeah, all
That's
of those.
Right.
David, it has been fantastic listening to what you have to say about your book, The Secret Codebreakers of Central Bureau, How Australia's Signals Intelligence Network Helped Win the Pacific War, and it certainly did. You've brought to light so many things. I'm looking forward to finishing off this book, and I'm sure our listeners are going to really enjoy reading it. Thanks for your time today.
Thanks very much, Helen.
See you
It's been
again.
An absolute pleasure talking to you.